This is Helene Becker, and you've been listening to Authors Like Us.
But now I'm going to reply and say, hey, what about this guy? All right.
Okay, now I'm getting a very weird message saying your webcam isn't supported by Skype, which is simply not true. So it's obviously something wrong on my end.
All right, so, that's okay.
We'll just go for it.
Are you on a PC or a Mac?
A PC.
That was our
tone of, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I used to have a Mac. And when I went to the laptop, it was going to cost me like $3,000 extra to go. And I thought, well, maybe the aggravation would be, $3,000 versus a little aggravation. I'm still not sure if it's evened out, the aggravation factor.
Well, we'll ask you maybe at our anniversary next year of Authors Like Us. You can be our
check-in.
200th episode check-in.
Okay.
And we'll find that out.
All right. You can't see this, but we've just lost James.
I can see you perfectly.
Oh, okay. Well, then you've seen that James is gone.
And I'm anonymous.
Okay, and now back.
Okay, so let's get the show on the road, I guess.
So you wrote the Looney Bay All-Stars. No, first I have to do this. Sorry.
Okay, sorry.
You wrote Looney Bay All-Stars.
I did indeed.
When I work at Vancouver Kids Books, that is my go-to book for boys who are reluctant readers but love sports.
Yeah,
thank you for writing that. When I saw that on your website, I was like, oh my gosh, she wrote the Looney Bay All-Stars.
I am the Looney Bay All-Star.
He's gushing here a little bit.
Okay, so now we have
I'm a Canadian writer. We could use all the praise and flattery we can get.
Exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we just need to introduce ourselves on the recording here.
So let us do that.
I'm James.
And I'm Lee.
And you're listening to
Authors Like Us.
And we're listening, or we're talking to, we're going to listen too, but we're talking to Helene Becker. And where are you from?
I'm originally from New York, but I've lived in Toronto longer than I lived in New York. So I guess I'm Canadian
you're actually technically both Canadian and American.
I am technically a dual citizen, but my American relatives say that no, I've crossed over to the dark side. I'm Canadian. I say a boot. I don't know.
Is that the moment you know, the quintessential moment when you know you've changed nationality, when you start saying a boot?
I think I changed nationality when I actually started to care about hockey.
apparently I haven't changed nationalities yet then.
He doesn't care about hockey.
Well, I care about it because I wrote a book called The Hilarious History of Hockey, so it was incumbent upon me to care about it.
That's true. So you've written a lot of books.
I'm compulsive.
I can see that.
is that, are you being serious? Is that true? You consider yourself compulsive?
Well, I consider myself a true working writer, which means that you have to be productive all the time or you do not eat.
But surely most of us who are writers, we do have other jobs, even if that job is speaking at school. So you include that as part of your career, or do you mean truly you just love to just write?
I do a lot of school presentations, and that's certainly an important part, I think, of being a writer, not only because of the income that you get from that, but the contact with the kids.
Right.
I don't know how you could write in isolation without them. You know, when I had my own kids at a certain age, that was great. That was the subjects right there. But as they age out, you've got to stay in touch, right? You need to be with those kids, and you're so inspiring and fun to be with.
Yeah, you've got to have access to their energy, right, and their enthusiasm.
And their interests. You need to see what it is that's appealing to them. You need to see what they're wearing, how they're interacting, all of those things to stay current. I think kids are always the same, no matter where you are and what generation or when it was. But the little details that make your book seem dated versus contemporary,
right,
they pretty quickly.
No, I agree with that for sure.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's... the one thing that I find... making it really important to talk to kids is the technology thing. Because it's amazing how fast it changes.
Well, if you talk to the kids and you say, name a Pokemon character, for example, that will really send you over into the, oh, she's out of touch, more than anything. It's pop culture. That say, she's got the pulse.
See, I often make fun of myself for not... I mean, I work... James and I both teach kids... creative writing full time, so we have access to a lot of kids. But I often just make fun of myself for not understanding what they're into, kind of on purpose to try and aggravate them. So that's, you know, if you can't torture the odd kid, what's the point?
Well, I think it's actually our God-given duty. That's what parenthood is all about. You know, you must embarrass your children. You know, so I excel at that.
Excellent.
I have no guilt. No guilt when I do it. I just laugh even harder.
No, based on this picture you have on your Skype profile, it looks like you take great joy in doing it.
Yeah.
Well, I think life is all about finding that joy and hanging on to it. And we all forget it here and there. But the beauty of children is that they're a lot closer to it. They don't have quite as many obstacles. You know, they go out there and they're splashing in the puddle. And for me, that was always the line that you crossed over into adulthood, when you started to walk around the puddle instead of stomping in the puddle.
That's because a really interesting...
I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. That I've never really thought of the threshold between childhood and adulthood that way. But don't you think people are, at a younger and younger age, walking around the puddle?
Isn't that scary?
Yeah.
Really scary. I'm actually going to be doing a book on puberty. I'm starting writing it in a few weeks, aimed at kids 8 to 11, because the age of puberty has moved down so much that there's nothing in the market for them.
It's true. Are you doing it specifically for boys or for girls?
It's going to be so cool. It's a two-sided book. So cool. One side will be girls, and then upside down will be the boys' side. And where will the twain meet? In the centerfold, of course.
Yeah.
So that's where all the yucky pictures are going to be.
In the centerfold.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's really good. I know.
And I'll tell you this story. You can hear my dog in the background.
Oh, my dog's going to answer your dog.
Yes, we know. Andrew just came home. That's my son. So Ella's announcing.
Oh, do you need to take a break to embarrass him?
Andrew, do you want to be on Skype? Say hello to California. Vancouver. Ella. Sorry, you can't see Ella. Ella is immortalized in many.
This whole show is going to the dogs. It's a dog. It's the dog show.
Part you're gonna cut out, right? Because I knew he was gonna come home right in the middle.
No, we love this stuff.
This is the best part. this is the part that we live for.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, hi, honey. How is school? Hi. There we go. He's 16, and he is actually Reese McSkittle from the Looney Bay All Stars.
Excellent.
Oh, you, yep. James, you just heard on tape the voice of, you know.
Yeah.
That's Reese. The whole the hockey team in the first book, Pirate Power Play, was based on his teammate. Some of the names of the kids are from his team.
Really?
From his young days, yes.
How did the teammate feel about that?
How did your son feel about it?
I don't think she actually ever knew, because by the time the book came out, the team had disbanded. But another character in the Looney Bay All-Stars, her name is Bridget Moses, and that is my friend Kathy's daughter, and I made her pay me to be in the book, and what she had to pay is that she had to promise she will take care of me in my old age.
Oh, awesome.
Wow, that's a good payment.
Yeah, I need to do that. Yeah, because there's...
Well, right now, we've got the same people looking after us.
That's true. Yeah, Lee and I have a group of friends that have decided one of our friends has a daughter, and so when she grows up, she's actually going to take care of all of us.
Wonderful. Does she know this, by the way?
Yeah, she does.
Okay,
she rolls her eyes at us all the time when we tell her.
Well, that's wonderful. You should build a trust fund for her then.
Yeah. No, she has to be rich.
She's got a lot. We're not putting any pressure on her whatsoever. Yeah.
No pressure.
So, Elaine, tell us about the big Los Angeles trip that you just went with Carrie Lynn Winters, right? You were with Carrie?
That's right. Carrie Lynn Winters, me, and three other writers. That's Robert Weston and Wendy Kitts and Jill Murray. All flew down to L.A. to be part of the Airlift to L.A., which was a humanitarian fundraising book drive event that Canadian children's authors got together to help these horrible inner city schools in LA. So can I ask you the question that you're going to ask me? Why? Why did you go to LA to do this when there are needy schools here in Canada?
Why did you go to LA?
There are two reasons. One was because I was in California doing author visits last year, and I was just so appalled by what I saw. This shelves in those libraries in inner city Long Beach were literally empty. There was a shelf marked Scary Stories, and it was empty. And I thought, I can do something about this. You know, we can't save the world, but I can do something about this school. I have friends that live nearby. We'll do a book drive, and we'll get some books on those shelves. And between May and the end of June of this past year, we raised 650 books for that school. They were given out to the students and put on the shelves on the last day of school. But then it occurred to me that we could do something even bigger and get some, A, publicity for Canadian children's literature, which could always use publicity in the U.S., but also maybe get attention to the fact that school libraries are underfunded everywhere. In L.A., it's critical, but in Canada, it's also bad. We're going that direction. We're not there yet, but we're going that way. So we thought, well, what could we do that will call attention to this? I know from experience that if you say, hey, let's get together and get some books for a Canadian school, you get zero publicity because nobody cares. But we thought maybe we'd get some publicity by this outrageous notion, look, we're sticking it to the U.S., right? Look, the Canadians have to send aid to L.A. where the movie stars are. So we did actually get some good publicity in the U.S. for that. More important on the small level was more than 5,000 books were raised for the school. There were four murals were painted, plus new outfits were, there was rugs put in, rocking chairs to make a nice homey library in an inner city school. It was just a most awesome event. And now we're hoping to duplicate it on this side of the border.
Where did all the books come from?
1,500 came from Canadian children's authors who donated them, sent them to me, and Canadian children's publishers. Six different publishers participated in that, who sent books. The additional books were collected, either new or gently used, by the organization that we partnered with in California.
Wow.
It's amazing to me that, you know, here's my ignorance, I guess, but that a school would be in that bad of, a school library would be in that bad of shape to have empty shelves. And I guess I had a conversation with Carrie as well about this, and she was telling me some of the, like, some of the books that were there are so out of date, it boggles your imagination, like the politically incorrectness of some of them and things like that.
Well, the school in Parry Sound that I was at last winter that had the books called The Red Indian and Young John Kennedy on the shelves would be a pretty good indication.
Wow.
What you can find on a poorly stocked, underfunded school library, and that's what we're seeing across Canada right now.
Yeah, well, I know in Canada too, the really big problem. I don't, well, in BC anyway. I don't know about across Canada, but librarians, the job of the librarian in the school is being cut, and it's actually becoming a part-time position for teachers to take on, and you know, and without librarians there who are sort of, you know, they're experts in the book, with the books and what's current and getting kids interested in reading and making that their priority. Now we have a teacher who's already tired from their full-time teaching position, having to work a few hours a week in a library, and just doesn't have the time to, you know, figure out what books the students will want and how to get them reading. And it's, you know, I can almost see it in BC being that we will have great new books in the library, but nobody there to tell the kids about them.
You won't have the great new books in the library because there'll be no one to order them.
That's a good point too.
Yeah.
Or else
it's across the country. You have pockets where you don't see that, but in general the pattern has been over the last 10 to 15 years, first we cut it from full-time to half-time, then we divide you into among three schools, then we replace you all together with a library tech, and then because there are no results coming from the school library, we can't tie it up with any of our objectives, then we cut that all together. And to me, it's the most ironic and frustrating thing, because on one hand, everyone's going blah, 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 literacy, 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 literacy over here, and yet at the very same time, they're underfunding the library, both the acquisitions and the staffing. And it's shocking. If you'll find on my website, there's a assessment document that you can download. It's a questionnaire, and you can just bring it into your school, your kid's school, and you can say, hey, can we just check the quality of the library, compare it to standards? And the standards are not, you know, over the top. And it's for information so that you can see what would a good library look like, what should the collection look like, and also so that you can see that 9 out of 10 libraries in Canada don't reach standards.
I know working at a children's bookstore and dealing with a lot of librarians and hearing their stories, I see that happening too, and it's really quite sad, and it is frustrating. So it's really nice to see you know, Canadian authors getting together to do something about it. I find it really interesting though that you say that you know, going down to the States to bring aid to the States, because people will notice that, where nobody notices when people try to help a library in Canada. Like, why do you think that is?
Yeah, that is. I had the same thought. Why is that?
Boring. It's boring because we We don't really, as a society, care about kids or books. You know, sure, there are those of us, and I think there's three of us right here having this conversation, who clearly go, what? How could you not care about that? But our society doesn't. The people who say, oh, we love literacy and we love reading, a lot of them, they don't read themselves.
I'm laughing because you're right.
My favorite is the ones that say, oh, kids, they don't read. They don't really like books. There's so many other things that they'd rather do. We can't get them to read. And I look at them and I think, are you kidding? Kids lap up books. If you put them in their hands, immediately they almost all will start turning the pages. Now, that doesn't mean that they will always find a book that they like right away. There are reluctant readers who they'd rather be out playing hockey than reading. But if you give them a book on hockey, I can bet you they're going to pick it up and turn the pages. It's the parents who don't like reading.
Totally right. It's the old adage, you know, do as I say, not as I do, right? Because kids they model, right? Like, so they'll do what is modeled for them. And if the parents are not reading, the kids will not read. Yeah,
why would they
agree.
See value in something that their own parents don't value enough to do themselves?
And look at our society. We don't even have written instruction manuals with anything anymore. They're gone. Remember, you used to get something like a new computer, and it came with a manual telling you what all the buttons did. Now, you've got to figure it out yourself. We're a hunt-and-peck society. You know, does this work? Does this work? And only after a while, you find out by accident this cool thing it can do. Hi, puppy.
He's outraged by this as well.
He's saying he reads.
Do you think, I mean, so you said because, you know, if we did such a thing here and donated books, I mean, it's actually quite interesting because James and I are part of the Children's Writers and Illustrators of BC, and we actually have a collection of about, I don't know how many books.
100 books?
No, we have over, I don't know, 1,000 books, or I should know because I'm part of the committee for this, but we're giving away a lot of books, and we're going to give them away to a BC library. Like 600 books, and then we have another 500 that we're going to do something else with. Anyway, and so these are some of the discussions we're having right now about, it would also be nice to get BC authors some press out of this. So do you think this would be a more interesting story to the media if the U.S. came in and donated books to Canada, like the reverse of what you did?
Ooh, how humiliating would that be?
I think a lot.
Do you think it might actually get swept under the rug even more?
I don't know. Is that what you think?
Let's try it. Let's see if we can get some books donated from the state. Well, you could say that virtually every major chain store is all American books being donated to Canada.
No, I know, but that's the wrinkle here, isn't it? Right?
That would be interesting, though, if a bunch of American authors, like really big-name authors, all got together and did the same thing, and then came to Vancouver and went to the East End and donated, you know, to some school. I mean, that would be very embarrassing I think the media would love that because then, you know, it's...
I don't know. This is an interesting conversation because do you think a lot of times, like, the average... And I'm not talking about our circle because we live in a bit of a bubble. We all know writers and all our friends are writers. But the average person would... go, oh, that's nice, like, because they might just think that there's no authors in Canada to do such a thing.
Well, I think the media would like it because it's, we're forgetting you're here, sorry. We do this once in a while.
No, I'm putting the question to every, like...
Well, you are, and I shouldn't be answering this. What do you think?
I think that what you said about them not knowing that there are Canadian authors here, I think for a large segment of the population, that's what they do believe. And you can see it. I bet you get the same thing. Oh, you're a writer. Oh, so how do you sell your books? Do you do your art? How do you, you know, and they think that you've got a printing press in the basement and you're car stocking everything. They don't even understand that it's a real business and that there's an entire industry in Canada that's based on publishing these works of art for children. So
it's almost quaint, isn't it?
Yes, I love that. Yes, I am printing it. Actually, we don't even use a laser printer to print. We use an old stamp. I hand carve them. I've student them myself. And I am doing it. And it's interesting because some questions I get from people are very, what I think of as intelligent, educated, sophisticated people. And yet they, because they're not in a cultural industry, they don't understand it at all. So maybe they wouldn't notice. I'm hoping that what we can do, and the children's writers listserv through Canscape, there's been a lot of interest in, well, what projects can we do here now? This was inspiring that you were able to pull this together and it was so positive. What can we do? So Carrie Lynn Winters, for example, was talking about maybe getting her students at Brock University to partner with a local area school and do something. I have another acquaintance out in New Brunswick in Nova Scotia, and I'm going to be there for the Hackmatack Awards and the Fry Festival in the spring. So I thought, well, maybe we can do something in Cumberland County, Nova Scotia, because they really are pretty hard up. There was a school there that someone said, I think they could use your help. I was just talking to someone via email at the Toronto Star today saying, hey, would you support us if we did a project right here in Toronto, picked an inner city school? We could do it. You don't need a lot of money. A little bit helps, but you really just need the will, and you can make a huge difference. So wouldn't that be cool if we could get a network of all different projects coordinated across the country?
That would be cool.
I think it's fascinating. I have to be honest, I have a bit of mixed feelings about it, because I actually think it's just so wonderful that it's this grassroots level
that
endeavor, that it's not government funding, but at the same time it frustrates me that there's all these corporations, like you say, that are pushing literacy and they throw around these catchphrases, but where's the proof? Like, where's the do in all of this talk, right? And so I have such great admiration for you and for these types of endeavors, but at the same time, I feel like, whoa, where's the people that can really, like...
Yeah, I hear you, and I feel exactly the same way, because you think, we shouldn't have to be doing this to support public schools. That's what we have a public school system for, and why we pay taxes. So why should we have to do this out of our own will and our own budget? In order to make something that's supposed to be our public institution, should be thriving just on its own. Our government should be funding it properly. And I know there's waste in government, I know all of that. But still, there's something not quite right with the picture.
Yeah. What worries me about all of that is, I mean, private schools aren't having these problems, and they're, you know, they have the librarians and they have the books, and we're almost creating this two-tier society where anybody who goes for public education is going to wind up with a much less education than somebody who can afford a private education. And, I mean, the little conspiracy theorist in me almost thinks that, you know, this is something that maybe the government is wanting to do. Maybe they're wanting to create this two-tier society where they have the upper and the lower class, and they want to get rid of the middle class altogether.
Just so you know, Elaine, James is working right now on a zombie apocalypse novel. So he's been hanging out in bomb shelters and going to military supply stores and eating military ration style meals. Can I say that online?
Yeah,
I just did.
Yeah.
So,
but
he's really into conspiracy theory right now.
But I mean, you know. The conspiracy theorists are all crazy until something actually is true, right?
Well, I'm going to throw a sticky wicket then into your conspiracy theory, because, again, you know, being writers, we go into schools all the time. So I've been in rich schools, poor schools, private, whatever, and I don't find that there's any real difference between whether or not it's a private school or a public school. There are some very, very poor private schools that you're paying big bucks for, and I wouldn't send my kid to them, because I'm thinking of one in particular. Private school, you know, $10,000 a year to send it, and that school library is pathetic, and they don't have a librarian because they also don't think it's necessary.
Wow.
But they have a beautiful athletic program. Mm, very nice.
Yeah, that's always been the way.
That's always, yeah.
So I know, like, a lot.
So I'm James.
I'm Lee.
And you're listening to
Authors Like Us.